Hola. So returning very briefly to the topic of path, which figured very prominently this morning, with respect to the very possibility of experiencing and sustaining a sense of sublime well-being, devoid of unhappiness or suffering, and that if that's a question, then the answer is path, it's marga. It's just exactly that. And of course, there are many different paths. I don't know how many lineages there are, or Nyingtik, for example. There are heart essence teachings. I just heard Kunzan Nyingtik of Samanta Bhadra, and Khando Nyingtik, and the Longjin Nyingtik, and so many. And they're not all the same. If they were, then why? It would just be completely redundant. So each one has a certain nuance to it, you know, and they will be then suitable for different individuals. So it's all wonderful. It's wonderful to have such diversity. And that's just within the Dzogchen lineage, let alone all of the rest of the wealth of diversity of practices within Nyingma tradition, and all four schools of Tibetan Buddhism, and so forth and so on, all the way out to all aspects of Dharma. And that said, in terms of this lineage of Dzogchen Lingpa, it just strikes me as something wonderfully sensible, just a really ordinary term, sensible and simple, never meaning easy, because it wouldn't, why would it be easy, but sensible and simple for sure, in the sense that he just, in one feather, he just goes right to the core with no elaborations, nothing formulaic, nothing ritualistic, nothing simply doctrinal. But what are the ways of viewing reality that will enable you to develop sufficient, again, escape velocity, the momentum, the motivation, the authenticity of the motivation that will empower you, sustain you, again, always sustainable, as you venture into the depths of the mind in shamatha and so on. So the outer preliminary is exactly for that. But then, especially when you're getting near the actual achievement of shamatha, and you're starting to be drawn into that marvelous, delicious, ambrosial dwelling of bliss, luminosity, and non-conceptuality. And it's just the warnings everywhere in Tibetan Buddhism, I think equally in all four schools, and that is how, on the one hand, imperative this is, indispensable it is, and everywhere. Don't get caught. How are you not going to get caught when this is better than anything you ever imagined, and you can get into it and sustain it whenever you like, and all you need is a little bit of food to sustain you and go right back into meditation? How exactly are you not going to get caught? And it's going to be with wisdom. And the wisdom will be, number one, if you've really fathomed the nature of suffering and karma, you'll know this is just a nice little time out, but it's not liberation. But beyond that, as you venture into the Guru Yoga, into pure vision of your Dharma siblings, and then really, ever so importantly, viewing all sentient beings without exception with compassion, and not simply an aspiration, but really more in the mode of Maha Karuna, then you'll know how wonderful it is to be able to pause for a moment in that delicious ambrosia of shamatha and to enjoy the pliability, the malleability, the suppleness of your mind. It's kind of like, wow, I can work with this, you know. And then knowing, and now let's happily roll up the sleeves and let's get down to it. In the deeper cultivation of bodhicitta, vipassana, and so on. And so sensible in the sense that, yeah, you definitely need those. You're not just going to wander into shamatha, achieve it because it was so easy to do, and then slip into the three qualities and then just know, oh, I'm not going to be attached, and move right on. It's not going to happen. It's not going to happen naturally. You really have to bring about these profound revolutions in the way you view reality, your perspectives, to be able to propel you through these and on to the path itself, and so you can continue on the path. The sensible part is, with those foundations, those preliminary practices, then the shamatha is just transparently commonsensible. Because otherwise nothing is sustainable. You can't even be angry sustainably. You'll get distracted. Now, why am I so pissed off at you? I can't remember. Ah, fool, I can't be. Remind me, why am I so pissed off at you? Oh, thank you. And then I get distracted again. You know, you can't do anything. You can't even be a, you know, 100% homogenous, really committed asshole. You can't, you know, you just wind up flaking out again and kind of being nice or kind of namby-pamby, you know. So You really can't do anything with real continuity without shamatha. And if it is shamatha, then of course you won't use that to sustain anything unwholesome. It'd be silly. That would be also not commonsensical. But then from there, if let's just slip over into the metaphor of being in a non-lucid dream, right? And being guided by a person who is lucid. So within the dream. I think I might have mentioned that years ago when I was teaching in Phuket in one of the eight-week retreats, one of the students who was quite gifted in lucid dreaming, he told me back then when we had weekly interviews, he said, I was dreaming along just during the past week, and in the dream, someone appeared, I don't recall who, but someone appeared, and he simply said, you know this is a dream? And that was enough. Bang. He became lucid. So you should meet people like that. Get out more. Because maybe that'd just be enough. You know this is a dream? Oh yeah. And then he was lucid. And so, but imagine that maybe for some people it's not so easy. Like, what are you, stupid? And then just walk away and, get on with your dream. But the commonsensical part here, within the non-lucid dream, and let's imagine you have a teacher that's guiding you, the teacher has emanated as a tulku into your dream, and then is there really simply to guide you. And he can't simply make it happen, right? Can't just make it happen. Can't simply give you, you want shamatha? I got plenty. And then, oh, you want vipassana too? Sure. And oh, texture? Oh, no problem. like a seal, Three fish. Thank you. And in a rainbow body. No rainbow seals, no rainbow body. Doesn't happen that way. Even the Buddhas have to guide you, step by step. And so, but the sensible part of this is, all right, within that dream, you learn how to practice shamatha. So then, okay, now you mind that really works. And then on that basis, now that you can do something sustainable, then you can easily imagine in a kind of a long dream, the teacher, your guru, lama, whoever it may be, then guiding you in vipassana and really inviting you to probe into the very nature of yourself as the agent, phenomena out there, are they really there? These type of analyses, the basis of designation, the illusory nature of appearances. And you can imagine within this dream where you're practicing, and this is a crucial point, all along I'm practicing preliminary shamatha and practicing vipassana, who is it that's practicing? And you'd say, me. As in, you're completely identifying with the person you are in the dream. Now, if your teacher has well guided you in vipassana, then you'll say, ah, I see, I'm not inherently here. There's no inherently existent self. Ah, personal identitylessness, phenomenal identitylessness, I get it. And so then you would still be in the dream, but know that you're not inherently existent in the dream. But you would still think, this is who I am, not inherently existent, but nevertheless, I'm not non-existent. Nobody ever said anything that silly. Like I don't exist at all. I do exist, not inherently. And you carry right on being in the dream and practicing within the context of the dream as a person within the dream, right? You can imagine that. And then the teacher would say, now in between sessions, the teacher, almost bursting with laughter but not letting it on, and now that you've, achieved shamatha, you've gained deep insight into the dream-like nature of phenomena. I mean, this is where the teacher would be cracking up, but kind of imagine this is a dream. Go ahead, try to imagine. Now you realize everything is empty of inherent nature. They're appearing, but, just like a dream. So imagine this being like a dream when you're not meditating emptiness itself in your post-meditative practice. Imagine this is just like a dream. Yeah, okay, got it. This is just like a dream. Yeah, that's exactly it. I mean, the Buddha would be laughing. But you're getting very close and you're still thinking this is like a dream and you're still identifying nominally, without revocation, to yourself as being the person in the dream. And then finally, your Italian guru takes off her sandal and goes, pet! And then you just knock it off. And suddenly you shift, because you are so ripe. You're like one of those peaches that it's just so ripe. You just go, and then it falls, You're so ripe. It could be pet. It could be a slap with a sandal. It could be, do you know this is a dream? And you tip right over. And then suddenly the whole axis of your perspective shifts from that being from one who is viewing the dream within the dream as the dreamed persona to one who's awake. And viewing this emanation of yourself, you would be seeing the embodiment of yourself in the dream as a tuku, of you. This is a display of foreseen awareness. And you would see all your thoughts within this dream. Now you're viewing yourself within the dream from the perspective of being awake, and you would see your body being an emanation of your own awareness, your speech being an emanation of your own awareness, and all your thoughts being an emanation of your own awareness. You would see that. You wouldn't visualize it. You would see it, right? You would simply know that all the appearances, so-called objective, so-called subjective, other people, yourself, that they're all equally nasty people, nice people, etc. The hell realm part of your dream and the nirvana part of your dream, that you would see all of these equally of one taste as being expressions of the awakened awareness that is attending to it from that perspective, right? So it's very sensible. It's very sensible step by step. Preliminary, shamatha, vipassana, and then cutting through texture like that. So very sensible, just straightforward. And you can always, of course, you can augment that simplicity, shamatha, vipassana, texture, with any other practice that are helpful. But the core of it is very simple and sensible. Having said that, though, there are individuals with different capacities. And this crops up in my very limited reading, in two ways very explicitly, in two out of the four, Vajra Essence and Enlightened View of Samatavajra, two out of the five, then there's this practice of merging mind with space. You recall? And that you do it for 20, 21 days, maybe with a bit of variation, but the point being that if you're of medium faculties, medium sharpness of faculties, then within 3 weeks or so, just by releasing your awareness, your mind into space, that alone, with no real effort being given to vipassana, and no real effort even being given to shamatha, just that may be enough to bump you right into realization of rikpa, in which case then your practice becomes simple, rest in rikpa. Right? And you simply skip the stages of shamatha vipassana, because you've already come to where the point that those were designed to bring you to. So that can happen. So one way is that, without that step by step, you simply release your mind, your coarse mind, subtle mind, into space, release it, and all that's left is rikpa, you realize it, and you're home. So that's a possibility. And here's the crucial point, by the power of your realization of rikpa, viewing reality from the perspective of rikpa, you will necessarily know that all appearances, all phenomena are empty of inherent nature. Just as if you're having an ordinary dream, just cruising along ordinary dream, and then something anomalous happens, and then you just become lucid. That's not uncommon. But with no shamatha training, no vipassana training, just something happens, and then you suddenly have that discontinuity of viewing the dream from the perspective of being awake, and you're suddenly lucid, right? It can happen. In some cases, maybe even very lucid. You really, really get it. And in that instant you become lucid, then you know that everything in the dream cannot possibly be existing from its own side out there or from its own side in here. And you just know that instantly. So that by the power of realization of rikpa, then you necessarily know the reality of great emptiness, of mahashunyata, right? So there's the point. It's sequential, and yet for some people, they will just, you know, they'll be so ripe. They'll simply realize rikpa, and then they can achieve shamatha while resting in rikpa. And the realization of vipassana is implicit in the realization of rikpa. And the practice goes simple really, really quickly. Yeah. And the other one is in natural liberation, in a shamatha practice, you would call it, where you're inverting your awareness in upon the mind as the agent, the mind as the observer, and then releasing, inverting awareness in upon the mind as agent, as we're releasing. And Padmasambhava says that may be sufficient for realizing rikpa right there. In which case, he hasn't even started in natural liberation. At that point, he's covered the preliminary practices, shamatha, but he hasn't even touched vipassana yet. That's the very next chapter. So without even having touched vipassana, we're not even beginning vipassana. It's possible, because he says it, people must have done it, that they will realize rikpa right there in the shamatha context. In which case, no, that's it. Just rest in rikpa. you know. And so that's what I'd like to do with this session. It's not a fishing expedition to see which one of you will pop. Yeah. It's just that, let's just have a really soft, fluid, malleable awareness here. That on the one hand, it's quite reassuring to me. Really, it's very reassuring, because I'm something of an intellectual. I'd like to think things make sense, you know, and this does. So it's reassuring to see this really makes sense. The preliminary practices, elaborate or concise, he gave concise. The shamatha, the vipassana, texture, view, meditation, conduct. It just, I get it, I'm in, I'm all in. It really makes sense. And having made sense, and having been introduced to the view to some extent, as we have, at least in the mud and feathers, that was pretty brilliant, then that's there in your mind stream already. That's been tucked in. You've gotten the infusion. Infusion, yeah? And so then, with that, just in the background of the awareness, imbued, your awareness being imbued with whatever understanding inside you have from that, then you may go right into non-meditation. And rest there. With the motivation, imbued with some understanding of emptiness, imbued with some understanding of the Dzogchen view. Just go right there and know, in principle, it's possible. You might just be there sublimely not doing anything. I was about to say doing nothing, but that's too much. Because doing nothing implies doing something. Nothing. You know, it's like the third of the samapatis, the absorptions in the formless realm. And what is the object? Nothingness. But it's still an object. It's not shunyata. It's nothingness. That's still something. It's still within samsara. Right? And so we're not, I mean, this is really finessing, but we're not doing nothing. Because that's just a little bit less than doing a tiny bit. But it's still doing. It's still doing. Right? So we're not even doing. Just releasing all doing. So, let's do that. Whoops. With images of unknotting, unraveling, unwinding, dissolving, melting, settle your body, speech, and mind in the natural state. And through this process of elimination, of releasing and releasing, a process of subtraction, releasing all identification with, releasing all grasping and reification. Ever so simply, let your awareness come to rest. Releasing all the tension that goes along hand in hand with grasping of any kind. And rest for just a little while, taking no interest and not deliberately directing the attention to any of the appearances to awareness by way of the five sensory doors, the physical senses, or by way of the mental door. They arise, they pass, without deliberately focusing on them, while letting all your interest reside and simply awareness resting in its own place, illuminating and knowing itself, just for a short time. Awareness of awareness. Awareness or shamatha without a sign. And even here, there's bound to be a vestige of grasping. How so? Because you've chosen not to attend to appearances, to turn away from them, and to rest in awareness. It's a choice, it's a decision, it's an activation of your sentient being's mind. It's doing something. So now let's release that. And all six doors of perception naturally open effortlessly. The light of awareness flows out unimpededly in all directions. without doing anything. You are aware. Awareness is effortlessly. And without doing anything with your mind, without identifying with anything of your mind, simply rest in this open presence, in a mode of 100% pure, unadulterated via negativa, not doing four knots just to see that you are not missing anything. Resting without desire. Without striving. Without modification. And without doing anything at all, not even meditating. So rest in unelaborated awareness. And if at some point in the session you find you are caught up in distraction, wandering, excitation, and so on, you fuse with the activities of the mind, you're not doing this practice incorrectly. You're doing something else. So then just stop. Release. And no more. It is simply a release of all activity, with nothing in addition. What remains without doing anything at all is unadorned, unconfigured awareness. So let's continue now in silence. Well, not so. So now we return to the teachings of the Lekwan Vajra of Oregon. We've covered just the first paragraph. But he states very explicitly here in the bottom sentence of this first full paragraph, the complementarity between the approach taken here in this teaching relative to the previous one of Avalokiteshvara, where the previous one was all about not finding the emptiness. And by having such realization, then you will naturally come to see the manner in which all phenomena, conditioned phenomena, arise as dependent related events. You'll naturally come to see how all appearances are illusory or misleading. And here he's taking just the opposite approach, coming to the same conclusion. So, in terms of this whole theme, that appearances of this mind are called dependent related events, for they are interrelated as a sequence of events like the sun and its rays. So, he continues then, this is like the appearance of an illusion. And this is an illusion, literally an illusion, created by an illusionist. And of course we have brilliant ones today, drawing, by and large, they're drawing on very, very sophisticated technology, and creating the visual illusions that appear like something's actually there, and of course it's not. So, same theme, but of course, as we excel, we in modernity excel perhaps to an unprecedented degree in our development of hedonic science. That's what I would call it. Hedonic science is looking outwards, and from which we derive many, many, many hedonic benefits together with the technology in the contemplative traditions of Buddhism, for example, then. It's all eudaimonic science, and all of the technology is within. And it starts with samadhi. That's your basic technology. And so this is like the appearance of an illusion that arises independent upon the interaction of transparent clear space, the primary cause. So we've got that. So now we see the similarity there. Earlier it was that for all these appearances, the primary cause is indeed space, but it's a space of awareness. And then that's catalyzed by various contributing conditions, and then all appearances arise within the space of awareness. So in a very, very similar fashion, as an analogy then, we have the interaction of transparent, clear space as the primary cause, and then what are the contributing factors that enable or trigger or configure the particular type of illusion that's going to manifest. It's only because there is such space there that these contributing causes can actually conjure up an illusion. But space by itself doesn't conjure them up. It's just transparent, clear space. So we have that as the primary cause, and then with the magical substances, mantras and mind that views the object being the contributing conditions. Now, magical substances, I haven't checked the Tibetan just recently, but I was assured by somebody who knows what they're talking about. I think it might have been Ganden Dugur Rinpoche, the wonderful Bhutanese Lama, who's seen this take place. He saw such an illusion created by one very accomplished yogi in the south of Bhutan not long ago. But he assured me that when it says ze, which simply means substance, and I'll check the Tibetan, maybe I should take out magical, that it's an ordinary substance. So for modern technology, David Copperfield, the other very, very famous illusionist, well, they're nothing simple at all about their technology. I'm sure it's very expensive. Whereas when referring to a substance here in this context of how do you create an illusion, principally by the power of your samadhi, as we'll see, there is a token, and it can be something as simple as a stick or a pebble, something really ordinary, but it's something like a plant. I haven't done it myself, so I don't know exactly how it works, but I was assured it's not some special alchemical substance that you have to conjure up. It's an ordinary thing, but that's kind of like a basis. And so the first thing is substance. The second one is very interesting, mantra. And the mantras seem to be, because I've seen this happen myself long ago, many, many years ago, 1971 or very early 72, I saw this happen where a very specific mantra is used, And then the mantra must be, how do you say, have a direct bearing on the type of illusion being created. Because I saw that myself. And so a different mantra will conjure up or kind of direct a different type of illusion. Right? So that's the second one. And there's a wide, tremendous variety of mantras that may be used, giving rise to a tremendous variety of illusions. So the substance is ordinary, the mantra is not. So I have in my library a book I've never studied, and I won't, but it's a big, fat book, and I picked it up more than 40 years ago, on the use of mantras in advanced levels of traditional Tibetan medicine, where the doctor is an accomplished yogi with very, very highly developed samadhi and is thoroughly trained in traditional Tibetan medicine. And it was a book maybe 400 pages long and big pages. And it was just chock full of different mantras, a whole bunch of different mantras. They'll be completely useless unless you really know the practices involved with them and unless you have really powerful samadhi. Without that, I think it would just be fee-fi-fo-fum. It wouldn't make any difference, you know. But if those mantras are used with the power, the directing power of like laser-like power of samadhi, then in this big book, then there were lists and lists and lists of very specific physical illnesses that could be healed with a particular mantra. It's quite interesting. I remember one that really caught my attention was hemorrhoids. Yeah. And it wasn't because I have hemorrhoids. I never have. But I thought, that's interesting, hemorrhoid mantra. I didn't memorize it. Otherwise, I'd definitely share it with you right now. So the second one is mantra, but that's where you get a lot of variety, right? And the mind that views the object, he doesn't say it here, but it's very well known. The mind that views the object is a mind that is very much empowered with samadhi. Samadhi, very far. So very much like a laser, right? So those three, the substance, kind of the plant, and then the mantra, which is, again, that's like the software. If we're going to use modern terminology, that's the software. I mean, so you got your hard drive. How many kind of software can you run on that thing? Well, the imagination's the limit, right? And so, but the hard drive, the energy, the juice, or visceral projector, the light source that's going to make this happen, actually project that image in space that it looks like it's really there, of course, that's the mind. Empowered mind. So I call this relativistic psychology. There's nothing very novel or clever about it. But I think it's not trivial. And it is prior to 1905, it was non-relativistic physics. I mean, they didn't know of anything else. They had no idea that anything traveling near the speed of light would produce unusual effects. And so it was non-relativistic physics. And then 1905, Einstein published his paper. And then we see relativistic physics, that if any body is traveling near the speed of light, like even half the speed of light, let alone 80%, 90%, 99%, that just reality starts getting really weird very quickly. Space, time, matter, energy, everything just starts shifting, and it arises relative to the initial frame of reference. So it's another now whole dimension, and of course that's possible only because the luminiferous ether as an absolute medium that permeates space isn't there. So we have relativistic physics. And prior to that point, all physics was non-relativistic, because it was just everything that was being considered was traveling way, way, way below the speed of light. Right? And what we have right now, I think this is very literally correct. It's in no way intended to be pejorative. But in virtually all the studies, and maybe all of the studies, scientific studies of mind, including studies of meditation, including studies of Tummo and things like that, it's all non-relativistic psychology from the scientist's perspective. Because their own minds are not, how do you say, hyper-powered with samadhi. And so the world, as it's conceived, is a world of a non-relativistic psychology where mind plays a very muted role because it's just wimpy. It's just wimpy. You know, it's subject to laxity, excitation, and so forth and so on. And so, but if you develop shamatha, that would be crossing the threshold into relativistic psychology, and that really is the threshold, achieving shamatha, let alone the addition, powers or what have you, of vipassana, vajrayana, dzogchen, and so forth. But as soon as you've crossed that threshold, and it seems to be really crucial, you've crossed the threshold, your awareness has moved across the threshold from the desire realm into the form realm, and imbued now with the five jhana factors, free of the five obscurations, then all of the sources, I mean, all of the sources in the Tibetan tradition for sure, as a teacher himself says, if you've achieved shamatha, then extrasensory abilities, paranormal abilities, they're at your fingertips, right? And that's where we get this really weird stuff happening of remote viewing. Well, it sounds like magic, but as Arthur C. Clarke said, the great, you know, science fiction writer, he said, you know, any degree of technology sufficiently developed but not understood will look like magic. So a cell phone that we have right now would look like total magic in 1950 when I was born. Like, oh, wow, there was an ET, it was extraterrestrial. Who gave you this, you know, this incredible thing? Even better than Superman. Remember, who was it had a watch?
Dick Tracy.
Dick Tracy. Wow, a watch. Hello, wow, supernatural watch. I think it's called an iWatch, right? In any case, this is relativistic psychology where the mind is empowered and the mind now is a player and it can conjure up appearances. You may be able to practice remote viewing. You may be able to transform physical stuff with your mind, right? And there's nothing magical, mystic, mysterious about it at all if you know the technology. And if you don't, then even the most primitive technology can look like magic if you don't understand it. You know? So that's what he's getting at here. So without belaboring this point, but it's just a very classic example that you bring these together, none of which are the illusion, none of which by themselves can create the illusion. Space, you know, wait as long as you like. It's not going to just pop up with an illusion itself, by itself. Nor that the let's say it's a stone. You know, watch the stone. It's not going to produce anything. Just the mantra by itself. Say, just say the mantra. Keep on saying it. See what happens. Nothing. You get hoarse, that's about it. And just samadhi, but with no program. Samadhi with no program. Just samadhi, just go into samadhi. Nothing extraordinary is going to happen in the observable world just by a person going into deep samadhi. Okay, you get bliss, luminosity, non-conceptuality. Other people don't know. It's internal, it's private. So then, well, that's cool. Have a nice day. But you bring these individual ingredients together, the space, which is the arena from which this appears. The substance, and it's a mystery to me exactly what that role is, but there it is. They always say it, and I take them very seriously. And then the program, I think it's exactly that. The program is the mantra. And then the power source, which being the samadhi, none of these individually capable of conjuring up image. And then there's the image. And so it appears to be there from its own side, and it's not. So the whole point here, and he's going to repeat it again and again, so I'm belaboring this or elaborating a bit only the first time, because if we really understand it this time, then we can see how does this relate to what we're experiencing right now? Because he's saying these are all analogies for what we're experiencing right now, right? That the appearances, all the appearances, the ladies on the that used to be walking on the tennis court and everything else appearing to be really out there, even so much so that you can go and tap on the shoulder or shake hands with them. Oh, yes, you're here, you know, and it just reinforces, oh, you were really there, I thought so, I shook hands with you. That all these appearances that seem to be really out there are not. They're rising independence of on a primary cause and then contributing circumstances, and then the illusion is there as if they're from their own side. It's a fascinating point, this one. I mean, it's fascinating, intriguing. Because we all know about, all of us here, there's nothing complicated about how we can dehumanize each other as human beings, dehumanize animals, or what's the word, because they're not humans, but, you know, just view them as objects. I mean, it's been done a lot. We know how that can, it's called the I-I relationship. It's perfectly clear. Nothing unusual about it. That there's nothing looking back when I look at the eyeglass carrier. It is simply an it. That's it. We're finished. But any sentient being, there's more. And the way I often phrase it, and I think it's fine to say this, is that if you gaze at an ant in your bathtub, it may not be able to see you, but it is looking. It's looking. It has its own perspective, right? Every sentient being has its own perspective. And so if the ant could look at you, then you'd be looking at the ant, and the ant would be looking back, and what should we say? From the ant's side, where else? Right? And then we empathize. We don't want to kill it. Yeah, I don't want to be killed. Don't want to kill you either. So we're cool. And so, but that's the phrasing. It's very meaningful, isn't it? It's very sensible. I look over at Corey, look into his eyes. I recognize human being. You look a lot like me, except for better. You know, and there he is. And, but the sense, I mean, just, you know, he's looking back. Right? Except we're here in the midst of Vipassana. Is there somebody looking back from his own side? So we must, I think, engage with this reality on this relative level. Not be too fast to jump off into Vipassana. Because we'll jump into the deep end of the pool and drown. Into he's not there, I'm not here. And then we just fall into nihilism, into an abyss of nihilism. Don't want to go there. Not helpful. So on the one hand, relative as a step on the path, to really get it, that when you're attending to another sentient being, they are the center of their mandala. They are there as much as you are here. But maybe that's the key. Right? Sundu is there from her own side as much as I'm here. I mean, she's over there and I'm over here. Yes, and no hierarchy. I mean, no more or less. I mean, complete parity. So, but then the strategy in Vipassana is, okay, I just said something that seems completely incontrovertible, indisputable. And now, as for me, because I'm not clairvoyant, I can't look into her mind, but I can look into mine, and I can see, all right, I just said that she's over there from her side just as much as I'm over here from my side. Okay, let's see, check in there. Who's in here from my own side? And then we're practicing Vipassana. We're practicing Vipassana we just finished. And that is the agent, the observer, the someone in here. Are you to be found? It's not self-annihilation. It's not self-negation. It's a simple question. When I seek within, do I find a nuclear self, an I, a referent within that's really there that it corresponds to the label I or given the person's name and so on? And you find that you not only don't find, but you find nothing to be found. And yet life goes on. You don't suddenly get swallowed into a void. Life goes on, appearances still arise. But they're all arising in this relational fashion, right? And we care, this is the important point, even after realizing, I think very important, even if we have some realization, some real insight into the sheer absence, the unfindability of there being an agent, a self, an experiencer, a subject in here, even when we see not to be found, consciousness continues, still luminous, still cognizant, and caring. Whether I'm empty or not, I still don't. There's still a wish not to suffer. Whether I'm inherently existent or not inherently existent, that wish doesn't vanish, nor should it, but it doesn't vanish. Right? That's important. The caring is still there. And so when we get this figured out, that it's not that I don't exist in that way, I just don't exist. It's not that I don't exist, I just don't exist in that way. But speech continues, and thoughts continue, and desires continue, actions continue. But they're all arising. Everything here in this matrix is arising as a field, an ongoing flux of interdependent, dependent related events. That it's quite right to call when it's convenient, I, or call by the person's name. And the flow of caring is as real as anything else, just put it that way. It's as real as anything else. Right? Not inherently existent, no it's not, but nevertheless it hasn't vanished. And with that understanding, where the caring is still there, then turning to Tsundu and looking her in the eyes and say, yes, there is someone there, of course. As much as there's someone here, there's someone there. Again, no hierarchy, no better or worse. Then it's compassion imbued with wisdom. Because to really care for another person, we don't have to reify them as existing from their own side. I think perhaps if one is starting out with this really, really reductionistic view that animals aren't conscious, even some we've read, human beings aren't conscious, human beings are just really robots. I think the first medicine there was no, they're actually looking back. Even say, they're looking back from their own side. Better that than regarding people as robots and mindless, because that just opens the door to inconceivable cruelty. So better to view sentient beings as being there from their own side than not to view them as the its. But once one has gotten some traction there, some understanding there, then you can go further. But you've established kind of a foundation so you don't slip into nihilism. Because I think this is what's happened in the mind sciences, and not everybody, but it's certainly a common theme, of a nihilistic view of the mind, a nihilistic view of people, human beings, as agents, and a complete reifying view of the brain. Absolute reification. It's absolutely there, it's chunky, it's meaty, and it exists from its own side, and it's the agent. So we're dumping all the ontological burden onto this chunk of meat, as Marvin Minsky says, the brain is a computer made of meat, you know, and saying that's the agent. So we're completely reifying that, and while placing all the weight of ontological importance on the brain, we, the mind itself, all the activities of the mind, and we as the agent just evaporate into nothing. So it's falling into two extremes. Extremes of nihilism and extreme of substantialism. And what we're seeking to do here, of course, is try to avoid all extremes. So here it is coming in by way of seeing the illusory nature of appearances by analogy. So he'll give one after another. And as I've said a number of times now, when you come to Dzogchen, just be ready for lots and lots of analogies. Not so much rational, step-by-step critical analysis as in logical syllogisms. They know how to do it, but we're in Dzogchen territory now. So we're going to be looking for a lot of metaphors, and there will be no dearth of metaphors. So we continue. In this way, all appearing phenomena manifest, all appearing phenomena, everything that appears, all appearing phenomena manifest due to the power of grasping at the eye, even though they don't exist. You read it one sentence like that and you know it. You're in Dzogchen territory. Glenn is very knowledgeable, and Corey, and I'm sure others here as well, very knowledgeable in the Galupa tradition. I doubt that you'd ever find that sentence. Don't think so. In any Galupa writing, nowhere. But then we have our my Lama, I'm sure of many of you, His Holiness, who is an absolute master. I think he's probably the greatest scholar contemplative of the Galupa tradition alive today. That's my very subjective evaluation. I doubt that there's anything significant about Tsongkhapa's view of emptiness that His Holiness is not aware of. And he's the one quoting a great Rimet master, that Tsongkhapa is writing as if from the perspective of a sentient being, where Longchen Rabchenpa is writing as if from the perspective of one who is completely enlightened. And so they're not operating in the same plane. So Longchenpa, or Dujum Lingpa for that matter, I don't believe would take Tsongkhapa and say, no, you're wrong, here's right. They appear, but they don't exist. You'll find that many, many times in Dzogchen literature. They don't exist. They appear, but they don't exist. There's no nuance there. It's not that they don't exist conventionally or from their own side, by their own trinity, and it doesn't, none of that. Just bam! So I've mentioned before, some of you already have experienced this over the last some days, ontological shock therapy or existential shock therapy, where he's going to be saying this again and again. They appear, but they don't exist. And if one is listening with a very open mind, very attentive, listening with faith and reverence, you can really feel you've just been thrown into the deep end of the pool where you don't exist. And nobody else exists. And therefore, why should compassion, what does compassion even mean? Because a non-existent entity can't feel compassion for another non-existent entity. I think we've thrown the baby out with the bathwater, out with the tub, out with the house. Yeah, I mean, we just lost everything here, you know? And then we have to see from what perspective are you writing? Not writing as if from a sentient being's perspective. From a sentient being's perspective, he would say exactly what Tsongkhapa said, I think, with certainly unsurpassed, I would say this with confidence, with unsurpassed eloquence, precision, and brilliance. How can you present the middle way view from the perspective of an extremely bright sentient being? And you would say, phenomena appear to exist from their own side, but they don't exist from their own side. They do exist, conventionally, by the power of conceptual designation. And so he's taking you in by the hand, he's extending his right hand and guiding you into the pool from the shallow end. So you hear that, and you're probably not going to leap off into nihilism. I do exist by the power of, as a flow, a matrix of dependently related events. And you feel, I've got something to hold on to there. I'm not nothing. I'm a flow, not of chunks, but it's just a flow of events arising in this mutually interdependent or dependently related fashion. But it still, I'm still here. I'm still here, just not chunky. But from the perspective of Rigpa, all the impure appearances of samsara are nothing other than that. They're just impure appearances. And they don't correspond to anything in reality at all. They are just impure appearances, like an illusion. Because from the perspective of Rigpa, looking over at Jucho, there is no sentient being there. No nuance. There's no sentient being there from the perspective of Rigpa. At all, period. I don't need to elaborate. Not an appearance of a sentient being. From Chucho's perspective, there may be an appearance of himself being a sentient being. But if he has that appearance and he clings to it, he takes it seriously. Delusional. He's wrong. And the Dzogchen Master's, the Vidyadhara's task is to get you over that. Right? So you don't grasp onto that which doesn't exist at all from a Rigpa perspective as being existent. Now, from a sentient being's perspective, sure. Conventionally, relatively, blah, blah, blah. So this is a phrase I think we really need to linger on, and I have now. But it's loaded. Again, as usual, the teachings here are very dense. So these all-appearing phenomena, he's referring to the whole of samsara, everything that appears in samsara, appears due to the power of grasping at the I. And that is, and it's everywhere. It's in classic Madhyamaka literature and so forth, that first there is the grasping to I, and you've seen this in the Klishta Manas, grasping to I. Manas starts to differentiate, appearances arise, appearances, this appearance, that appearance, and then the conceptual mind, with or without language, the conceptual mind turns on, just like turning an engine on. And then, object, subject, and suddenly they're designated, and then in the next breath, it's kind of like, reified. But it doesn't happen unless it starts here. It doesn't start anywhere else. It doesn't start by reifying something else. Reification starts with self. So that's why they often say that all appearances arise by the power of self-grasping. Not at all intuitively obvious. But if you see the sequence, you can see, yeah, if that hadn't happened, then this wouldn't have happened. If this hadn't happened, that wouldn't have happened. If that wouldn't have happened, then you would not have this phenomenal world of samsara at all. Not from your perspective. Had it not been for the initial grasping to self. So, this is Dzogchen context. Teachings from Lake Bornvadra. Don't expect anything other than his teaching coming from the view of Rigpa. I skipped one, didn't I? Yep. So I'm going to go back. In this way, all appearing phenomena... No, I didn't skip. There it is. All appearing phenomena manifest due to the power of grasping at the eye, even though they don't exist. This is like the appearance of a mirage due to the confluence of a lucid, clear sky. There's your primary cause. And then instead of a substance, you have warmth. And instead of samadhi, or mind, you have moisture. Those three... None, and, of course, the mirage is not there simply in the sky or in the warmth or in the moisture. So it doesn't really emerge from any one of those three. It manifests, but it didn't really come from anywhere. That's the crucial point. Just as when we're investigating the mind, where's the location, its origin, location, destination, not found, not found, not found. If you ask, where did the mirage come from? You don't actually see it coming from the space itself. Otherwise, you can say, well, then we don't need moisture or warmth. Space, do your thing. Let's see. Do it again. And it's not happening. It's not actually emerging. There's space. It's not actually emerging. Just exactly like the rainbow. Maybe no, I don't think he covers that here, although it's classic. I don't remember. But the rainbow, very, very similar. The rainbow is appearing there, and we know it's a space, it's moisture, it's light, those three. But if the rainbow were really emerging from the sky, then it would be right there. It would be right there in the space from which it emerged, which means you'd be able to go under it and look at it from the bottom, because it actually came out of the sky. But of course it didn't. It's not there. It's not there. It doesn't exist. If it existed, then you should be able to look at it from different angles. It doesn't exist. So there are the three, primary cause and then the two contributing conditions. We continue, all waking appearances, dream appearances, and appearances during the intermediate period, the bardo, and thereafter. After the bardo, next life, and etc. All these different types of appearances appear, and again this phrasing, even though they don't exist. So it's very, very important to know the context in which that is a true statement. As it is in the classic teachings within the Dzogchen context of dream yoga, where this is a very strong parallel. Daytime practice of dream yoga. I think a number of you know what I'm going to say here. It's kind of important. Daytime practice of dream yoga within Dzogchen context, as in natural liberation, for example. That you have your nighttime yoga that you are practicing just before falling asleep, and then what to do when you're in the midst of a dream, becoming lucid and so forth. But then you have your daytime dream yoga practice, right? And one of the things that you will be telling yourself as you're in the waking state, this is a dream. And if you've studied lucid dreaming, then you could have done a half dozen different state checks, pulled your nose, jump, read something three times, and so forth and so on, and persuading yourself beyond all reasonable doubt, I am not dreaming. I read this 13 times, and every single time it was the same. I jumped, I've run physics experiments, they all turn out to accord to the laws of physics, and so on. You could do this until you say, there is no doubt in my mind whatsoever that I am not in bed, sleeping and dreaming right now. And then the Dzogchen master will come and say, that's very well, this is a dream. And he's not refuting anything you said. Because from your perspective, as a person who's speaking from within the perspective of this ordinary waking state, it's not a dream, you're not in bed someplace, you're right. From the perspective of a sentient being, you're right. You did all those tests, congratulations, you're not dreaming, right? But if you bump into a Dzogchen master, a Vidyadhara, from that person's perspective, he will listen to all you, she will listen to all that you've just said, and said, very good. But in reality, this is a dream. Because my perspective, to be really blunt, the Vidyadhara would say, my perspective is more valid than yours. We hear that view a lot in the Mahayana. The perspective of an Arya, a person who's realized emptiness, I was about to use the word Trump, but I can't use that word anymore, overwhelms, Trump would have been perfect. It just surpasses. It surpasses the perspective of any being who's not an Arya. Because you're an Arya. You have seen how things actually exist. And therefore your perspective is better. And where the two are divergent or incompatible, we're not going to try to bully anybody into this, but it's simply true, the Arya's perspective invalidates the perspective of someone who does not know how things exist. There it is, it's all over the place, there it is. And then similarly, the Vidyadhara's perspective surpasses, there's a nice term, surpasses, bears greater weight than the perspective of someone who's still viewing reality from within the context of ordinary perception. Just as, very strong analogy, just as a person who is lucid in the dream, that person's perspective on the dream, knowing that it's a dream, surpasses the most brilliant scientist within the dream who's not aware that it's a dream. Because one understands the nature of reality being experienced, and the other one's got the details. Okay, something like that. So all waking appearances, so he's making a very, very large universal claim here. All waking appearances, dream appearances, and appearances during the intermediate period and thereafter appear even though they don't exist, and confusion arises due to reifying them. So they do appear. I mean, nobody's questioning that. They do appear. And the mere fact that they appear doesn't mean you have to be confused. As a Vidyadhara, or an Arya Bodhisattva, is not confused, but confusion does arise due to taking them at face value. Everything appears as if these phenomena exist from their own side, and they don't. But we take it at face value, we believe them, we trust them, we reify them, and then there is no end to confusion that arises from that. And once again, here, it's my favorite analogy. As an analogy during a dream, instead of thinking this is a dream and recognizing it as delusive, you apprehend it as an enduring, objective world and fixate on it. And as soon as you do that, there is really certainly no mental suffering that you couldn't experience, that you would experience in the waking state. I don't know this is true, but any mental suffering you can experience in the waking state, you could experience in a dream state. And certainly you can, oddly enough, experience physical pain in a dream, even though you have no physical body. And I just don't know, I've not had that range of dreams, whether the physical pain or agony could be as intense as in the waking state, that I don't know. But the simple point that is, I think, indisputable is that as soon as we reify the events in the dream, including ourselves, of course, and see it as enduring an objective world, and we fixate, which is to say we reify it, then we are vulnerable to all manner of suffering. And I think this really, one can linger there just for a moment, just seeing that, then you see the single-pointed urgency, the focus, the overwhelming focus in Dzogchen, that if we apply this to the non-lucid dream, there are all kinds of things you can do in a non-lucid dream to make it better, to be virtuous, to be ethical, take ordination, cultivate bodhicitta, cultivate bodhisattva, etc., etc., maybe develop paranormal abilities. There are many, many things you could do that could be worthwhile, right? And with the Dzogchen perspective, you say, that's all very well, but really, finally, when all is said and done, there's one thing more important than anything else. Wake up. Right now. Not after three countless eons, but it's already a dream. So right now, recognize the dream, and then everything will come unto you. And this theme comes up really sometimes with tremendous elaboration. If you realize Rigpa, then all the other virtues arise from that. You don't have to dwell on Rigpa, by the way, all the virtues that I can't get from Rigpa, I'll cultivate those on the side, like hedge fund. I'll invest as much in Rigpa as needed, but of course with my surplus, then I'll invest in the other things over here. You can, but it's overwhelming in Dzogchen. Every virtue of the Buddha's body, speech and mind, activities and so forth, every virtue will arise from this one source. And so therefore there's one thing to do, and everything else is simply a means to that end. When I was just sitting there doing nothing, or not doing anything in the practice, one thought that just came to mind, or maybe it was two, was coming way back to the ground floor, of shamatha, and back to the sutrayana, and back to the, if your shamatha retreat is going to be effective, what inner qualities do you need? And what kept to mind, just thoughts coming up, is contentment and having few desires. It's kind of obvious, because if you don't have both, you're going to get restless, and after a while you just want to leave retreat, because it's boring. It's just boring. Or, and this is something I hope we may have to contend with one day, and that is, you're up in one of the 20 cabins, and you're just finding boring, boring, but then you see this other person coming out of the hut, and he or she is looking good. Hi there. I really feel I like to talk. Not too fast, just nice and slowly. Get it in the net. Now retreat's fun. Because you got yourself a boyfriend, you got yourself a girlfriend. So I'm going to have one of those. When I was a kid, when I was in high school, I'm serious, the principal of our high school had a big paddle, hardwood paddle with holes in it. And if you got called into the dean's office, it was there to be used. Yeah. So. I'm sure I can find them on Amazon. Oh, you think I'm kidding? Go ahead and try me. Make my day. So there we are. This is a dream. But just to finish that point really simply, but the simple, we're right back down to the real basics, just shamatha, ordinary shamatha, right? But if you don't have the contentment and the few desires, you won't make it. But then I was just resting there, not doing anything, and I'm thinking, if one is seeking to engage in non-meditation, and you don't have contentment, and you do have a lot of desires, there's no way it's going to work. And then it says having few concerns and few activities. If you're still attached to your various concerns and the activities, many of which you may be very good at, and you're still attached to that, right? And then he says, completely release all compulsive, obsessive flow of thinking. If you're still caught up in that, so we're talking basic internal prerequisites for achieving shamatha. It looks like each of them is exactly designed to help you eventually rest in not doing. Because if you haven't cultivated those, there's no way you'll be able to. You'll get restless and have desires and feeling really bored and having discontent. And you'll start about thinking of all your concerns and activities, things like when you're doing nothing, then you can be thinking doing anything would be more meaningful than this. I mean, just picking my nose would be more important. Because now I can, you pick your nose, you can breathe easily. But you're not even picking your nose. Like, this is the most worthless thing I could even imagine. It's not as valuable as picking my nose. I think I'm going to do something. I've made my statement. So, you just go through that list. Pure ethical discipline. Without that, forget it. Few concerns, few activities. Contentment, few desires, and completely releasing, completely abandoning, it's the word bangba, completely abandoning all the entrenchment in the flow of rumination. Simple, basic, internal causes of shamatha. Seems like exact preparation for the culmination of practice, and that is not doing. Looks to me like that. So it really looks like to me like all the practices are flowing to that, which is, it's wonderful that all the practices are preparing you to not do anything at all. And the implication is marvelous, because if we had no Buddha nature, then you'd just be sitting there like a rock on dirt, because nothing would happen. And then, people wouldn't be teaching it. But then you've just absolutely struck into the very gold mine of gold mines, right? And then the rest is all blessing, given freely. So that right there, that simple practice not doing, is the strongest statement one can find. For people are teaching this and practicing for 100 years, they must have found something that is discovered when you're not looking. And that's simply given. That's good. It's very, very optimistic, right? And so, the appearances of various phenomena as something other, due to the dominant condition of inwardly grasping at the eye, so first the inward grasping, and then the shadow, or then the reflection, the other. These are like the appearances of reflections from the interaction of your face and the mirror. So this phrase, it's everywhere in Dzogchen literature, that all appearances are rang nang, your own appearances. Your own appearances. Of presidents, of dictators, of workmen, of dogs, animals, and all kinds of creatures. All appearances. They're all rang nang. They're your own appearances. Face and mirror. Whatever you're seeing in the mirror is an appearance of nothing other than your own face. that winds up being one of the most pivotal insights in all of Dzogchen, of not seeing appearances as other, not viewing them as other, not grasping them as other, because as soon as you do, it's kind of like the image that just popped up is like in the woods, Native Americans and trappers would sometimes set a wire, and you're walking along and you trip it, or a landmine. You step on it, goes click, or you've just tripped the trip wire, and as soon as you've tripped it, it's too late, right? It's too late. Now something's going to happen, and it won't be what you wished for, right? And the trip wire, grasping appearances as other. That won't happen if you don't grasp yourself. But if that does, the trip wire is grasping at anything as other. Watch samsara flow. Because everything will come now. Everything will come. Okay. Big. Oh, yeah. So we'll wait about Gandharvas. Gandharvas, that's the next paragraph. We'll get to that tomorrow. I did some background research on that. It was rather interesting, Gandharvas, because I never really looked into it before. This time I have, I think, sufficiently that I can say something that won't be incorrect. Interesting, though. But that's enough for now. So good, it's 6 o'clock. So now is the time to really, you're off the cushion, you won't be in formal practice for at least a little while. Now's the time just to do this, because this is perfect for between sessions. Because between sessions, you're seeing all these appearances. When you're sitting quiet in your room and it's dark and you're just resting in awareness of awareness, there's not much happening in terms of appearances, so you may not have a lot to work with. But as soon as you're off the cushion, like right now, and you see all these appearances, then that's the time to practice. That's the main time to practice. And of course, you can continue that when we all go our separate ways in 4 weeks. So very good. Enjoy the evening.